they say, and it makes us very happy when words stand up to be counted, and there's nothing too big or too small that we can't celebrate its language. From the names of planets to the tiniest punctuation, writing and conversation you can sink your ears into. The Verb, Friday nights at 10 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's midday and now time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Artist and printmaker Norman Ackroyd was born in Leeds in 1938. He fell in love with the landscape of the Yorkshire Dales, riding round on his bicycle as a young boy, and studied art despite his father believing it was a waste of time. He is now one of Britain's most acclaimed contemporary printmakers, with works in collections around the world, including the Tate, Rijksmuseum and MoMA. We've come to his four-story warehouse studio and home in Bermondsey to make this recording. The bottom floor is dominated by two huge black printing presses, Belfast sinks, pots of pencils and paintbrushes, inks and glass bottles of powdered resins, which Norman uses in the magical process of etching. We've climbed up to the first floor, where works in progress are fastened to the walls, elemental seascapes of rock formations in all weathers, with birds wheeling overhead. And in the middle of one wall, a sea chart of the British Isles. Norman likes to visit what he calls the furthest lands, so it's covered in pins marking the places where he's been to draw and paint. Do you feel a strong connection with music, Norman?
I always have, and there's a great tradition of music in the north, you know, with the Halley Orchestra and the Huddersfield Choral Society, and I've never lived in a house without a piano. And there's always been members of the family could play the piano, and I learnt very early as well.
There's a grand piano here in this building.
Of course, I couldn't live without it. So music has always been incredibly important.
The first piece of music you've chosen, I think, has a reference to your etchings and the work of etching.
Yes.
Schubert.
Schubert Impromptu. It's 6 minutes of absolute heaven. I sometimes put it on and I think I want to make an etching as perfect as this, both in its conception and in its execution. I'm very fond of Brendel's version of this, but I love Mari Pariah's version of it. It's just the most complete and perfect piece of music on the limitations of a piano. I mean, a piano is limited to 84 assorted black and white notes, and you get this magic out of it. It's a glorious piece.
Thank you.
sitting here looking at your works, and in fact one in front of me, where light is glistening on the water, the running quavers in that music.
It's the same thing.
It is.
For me, it's the same thing. And also, within that piece is great craftsmanship in terms of understanding the thing, and also in the playing of it. I love great craftsmanship. If you're going to do it well.
We heard the impromptu Opus 90, number 3 in G-flat major by Schubert, performed by Murray Pariah. I've seen also in your studios, Norman Aykroyd, CDs of Mitsuko Ushida. You've mentioned Brendel. So obviously the piano is very important to you. You were brought up in South Leeds, weren't you?
Yes.
I wonder whether you came across a piano when you were quite young.
My father bought a piano off a man in a pub. And it was a small grand, a German grand piano, and we had to take the casement out to get it into the front room. But my elder brother took up the piano, he loved it, and I took up it. There were five of us, but only two of us got onto the piano. But that's enough out of five. He played wonderful pub piano, Cole Porter and stuff, but I played simple classical stuff.
And do you still play?
I still play, but not very well. I can read music and I can set myself 3 months to learn a little Schubert impromptu or something.
There's some Mozart on the piano, I noticed.
There's some Mozart. There's a lot of very simple Mozart for somebody about my level, yes.
I wonder whether, given your work, the black and white notes have a kind of fascination for you.
Well, they do, because it's a linear limitation. The whole point of etching is it's limited to essentially black and white. It's also limited to the size of a press. You can't do massive etchings unless you piece them together. So it's almost like a poem to a novel is an etching to a painting.
So do you think that in a way, and perhaps this is something our society needs to remember, that less is more, limitation is inspiration?
Absolutely. It's also freedom, because you don't have to think about so many things. You're just thinking about containing a sonnet within 14 lines. Or an impromptu with exactly 6 minutes. And I love that. And some of the best etchings in the world are only the size of a cigarette packet, if you look at Rembrandt.
You also sang when you were a child, didn't you?
Yeah, but not very well. I didn't have a very good voice. But singing was very much part of my school days. Everybody sang in assembly, but I never made school choir. I wasn't good enough.
In terms of choral singing and large numbers of people singing, you've chosen next Cwm Rhondda.
Well, that is spectacular. I really admire the Welsh. There's a great tradition of singing in Yorkshire and Lancashire, of course, but we all bow down to the Welsh. And the idea of 50,000 people singing, and singing it rather beautifully and seriously, it really is incredibly moving.
Well, we've got a wonderful recording from the BBC Radio archives, recorded at a rugby match at Cardiff Arms Park in 1954, and this, of course, is Bread of Heaven, Cwm Rhondda.
Wonderful. It's just You have faith in human nature when people can get together like that and sing like that in such an uninhibited way. There's a future for the human race, you know.
Coombe Rhondda, or Bread of Heaven, sung by the crowds at a Welsh rugby match in February 1954 at Cardiff Arms Park. Norman, can you remember what you first started sketching? What were your first efforts at art?
In fact, very early, my elder brother, who was 12 years older than me, used to wake me up and take me fishing right up in the top of the Yorkshire Dales. Well, I wasn't really interested in fishing, and so I had to occupy myself through a whole day while he fished for trout and grayling and the odd salmon. And I started to take a drawing book with me then and just draw the surface of the water. And I've always carried a drawing book in my pocket since then.
After school, you studied at Leeds School of Art. Were your parents keen on this idea?
My mother was, but everybody else wasn't. You know, they thought I should go and get a job. But I got the strength of having a really good art teacher at grammar school who told me that people would try and knock me off my course, but said stick with it. And things changed when I actually was accepted at the Royal College of Art a few years later.
But it was at Leeds that you first encountered etching.
Oh, yes, and I was very lucky. I had a wonderful classical, old-fashioned etching teacher who taught me the grammar. Once you've got the grammar, then you can start to upset the apple cart.
What do you think it was that particularly drew you to etchings?
Well, I'll put this back in your court. You're a musician. Why do you take up the tuba? Why do you take up the piano? Why do you take up the clarinet? Because it's the one that you feel you can express yourself as making the imagery best, and it's the one that you instinctively feel is your instrument.
That's really interesting.
And yeah. So as soon as I'd done etching, I thought, this is a medium that instinctively I like. I feel a freedom with it, much more than paint, really. Although watercolour, I find, really, it's got the same kind of freedom. I loved the flatness of an etching. I didn't want to be a sculptor. And I loved the illusion of drawing a three-dimensional object on a flat piece of paper.
Is it very difficult to master the process? You've got the plates, you've got the chemicals, the ink, and then these enormous brushes. Do you quite like all of that ritual, if you like?
Well, the ritual, of course, slows you down. An etching goes in different states, and then you've got to sit down and have a cup of coffee and a cigarette and look at it. And even though it might sound a slow process, it in fact is quicker, because you've got to be more precise. It requires an elegance of mark-making, an elegance of thinking. And that's what I really like about it, because there are these gaps. And you never stop learning with etching. So every great etcher has moved etching on in a different direction. Picasso did it, Goya did it, Rembrandt did it. They all took etching and moved it on. I don't know whether I've done that or not yet.
Aged 23, you won a place at the Royal College of Art in London. It was the early 60s, an exciting time to be there, where everything was beginning to open up.
Absolutely, and all the different departments would overlap. You know, I would meet Mary Quant, Xandra Rhodes, all the people in industrial design and the graphic designers, the filmmakers, as well as the painters, the etchers. And we all met and overlapped, you know, and a lot of art schools now go into separate silos for all those departments. It's a great handicap. Art is everything, really. It's not just painting.
Your next music, and particularly the lyrics, I think, remind you very happily of this time.
Yes, and there are so many poems and pieces of music from that period. I could have chosen a couple of dozen. But this is a nice little short one, which I really like. I think it's pretty good.
Love Minus Zero, No Limit, from Dylan's fifth studio album, Bringing It All Back Home.
My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals of violence. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, yet she's true like ice, like fire. People carry roses and make promises by the hours. My love, she laughs like the flowers. Valentines can't buy her. In the dime stores and bus stations, people talk of situations Read books, repeat quotations, draw conclusions on the wall. Some speak of the future. My love, she speaks softly. She knows there's no success like failure, and that failure's no success at all. The cloak and dagger dangles. Madams light the candles in ceremonies of the horsemen. Even the pawn must hold a grudge. Statues made of matchsticks crumble into one another. My love winks, she does not bother. She knows too much to argue or to judge. Midnight trembles, the country doctor rambles. Bankers' nieces seek perfection, expecting all the gifts that wise men bring. The wind howls like a hammer, the night goes rainy. My love, she's like some raven at my window with a broken wing.
That's a love song, really.
And got your foot tapping, I notice.
Yeah. It's a bit special, really.
Bob Dylan's Love Minus Zero, No Limit, from the fifth studio album, bringing it all back home. Norman, many of your early works were of Leeds and Yorkshire, but you also went to live in the States in the 70s.
Yes, I was asked to go and be professor of etching in Richmond, Virginia, and then a little bit later in Indiana, Bloomington University, which was one of the big six. A Washington gallery took me on and showed me in the late 60s. And I got to know America very, very well, and I found the Americans incredibly welcoming. They also collected art in a different way. They put it on their weekly shopping list. We put it on our ten yearly shopping list. They bought art much more readily. Mm. And there was a feeling that one could make a living as an artist much easier in America than one could here at that time. They paid me very well to be a professor of etching, even though I was only about 30.
So what brought you home?
The land. I woke up one morning, I had a studio in New York for about 6 months, and I woke up one morning and I thought, I'm in the wrong place. But I came home and started to move in a different way here.
You moved a lot because you've done work in the Outer Hebrides, and you've been out on boats in order to really capture. Debussy, you know, went out on a boat before he started work on La Mer. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he wanted to experience a storm. Mm. Is that the kind of thing that you got from actually being close to water, being on water?
Yeah, there's no substitute for it. You're moving all the time on the ocean, and you've got to try and get it onto a flat piece of paper, which is quite a challenge. A lot of the time we get up before dawn, because some of the magic really happens at dawn with the light, and also at sunset. And there's no substitute for seeing the actual thing. I've not touched a camera for nearly 30 years.
So you'd sketch, and then you'd bring the sketches home and work on them.
Loads of drawing books.
And if you're about to start on a big copper plate, what does that involve?
First of all, shaking off any kind of inhibition and try and work on the big copper plate like you would on a little bit of paper on the boat. Try to bring that kind of freshness and the memory of what you were doing on the boat into it.
And do you sometimes listen to music when you're working?
Different times. There's different pieces of music in the background. I don't want to be listening to new music then, and sometimes it's got to be complete silence when I'm working.
What about the piece we're about to hear, Alfred Brendel playing Beethoven's Sonata No. 17?
As you know, I live above the studio, and if I've had one or two bits of paperwork that are niggly and everything, I come down, I put that on, play that once, and it sets the mood and it changes my mood completely, because it takes me right through to a completely empty mind again, in really beautifully. And then I can start to work on the real thing and not the administration. It's like taking an aspirin.
If not something stronger.
If not something stronger, yes. I mean, most mornings I will wake up and I will actually not look or answer the phone or anything, because I've start off in a really good state of mind and come straight down here. And a lot of the days I start about 6:30 and just come straight into the studio. And I might have that on very quietly or something else, but it's usually because I've got a bee in my bonnet about a picture I'm working on. So I'm coming down already with some kind of zip going on.
I find the same thing with music, and I wonder whether it's partially because during the night the subconscious has been continuing the work of the conscious during the day.
Yes, and also sifting out the rubbish and just leaving with the purity of what you really want to do. And you wake up with that pure vision, which has been uncluttered by the day's rubbish. And you try and keep yourself in that state of mind as long as you can. It's very difficult in this day and age, but you can do it if you really want to.
Well, Beethoven certainly did it, and there we heard Alfred Brendel playing the Adagio from the Sonata No. 17, The Tempest. There's a grayness in there too, though, isn't there, which I'm just looking at the work around me, and I can't help associating what I'm hearing with some of the images.
Absolutely, because although etching is black and white, by implication that means 10,000 variations of grey in between, and that's what a great pianist can get out of the piano. And you can get these luxurious grey deep chords, sometimes a violet grey or a pink grey. I mean, I actually see colour in some of the chords, you know.
And, synesthesia, they call it.
Is there a name for it, is there? I didn't know that. No. Yeah. And the greys that you can get in an etching between the white paper and the blackest black are limitless.
We're going to hear some sacred music next.
Yes.
Allegri Miserere. What prompted you to include this?
This was commissioned by the Vatican. But it's also pure voice again, but an entirely different thing to the Cardiff Arms Park crowd. It's amazing what you can get out of the human voice, and it was refined to a very high level in those days for religious music. And I just find it quite spectacular, really.
Allegri was a Catholic priest, and for a while the Vatican would only allow this piece to be heard in the Sistine Chapel, so much so that it thought that that's why Mozart went there and made a copy of it, by memory, by the way, leading to its publication.
I heard that. That's quite a talent, isn't it? But it's a beautiful piece. I find it very uplifting, you know, and when it hits the high C, you know, it just...
I was going to say, if you're the first soprano, it's particularly uplifting in a literal sense.
It really is, I think so.
Thank you.
an excerpt from Miserere by Gregorio Allegri, performed by the 16, conducted by Harry Christophers. There is something about that music which is quite transcending, isn't it, in a literal sense?
Yeah, it fills the studio sometimes. That high C sort of permeates every corner of the workshop and hangs about.
You like to bring people from different creative worlds together, Norman, I know, and you plan trips. Do you think you might want sometimes simply to be alone, or is good company always important?
On a lot of my trips I am alone, probably about a third of them. But some of the major things where I charter a boat for 3-4 days, it's wonderful to have artists, especially from other disciplines, musicians, writers, poets, archaeologists, historians. They're always amazingly valuable for knowing more about what you're looking at. And it's always wonderful when somebody composes or writes something to do with it.
And you've made several trips to the west of Ireland, haven't you? Do you love that coast?
I love the whole west coast of the whole British archipelago. Muckleflugger, the most northern point of Shetland, to the Bishop Rock in the Scilly Isles, is over 1,000 miles. There's so much has gone on that coast. The invasion of the Christians coming up and settling, making little monasteries on the rocks, and bringing culture and Latin and scriptoria, and then people eking out a living there, all against the odds, and to land on these islands and see the traces that they've left from the 6th, 7th, 8th century, even the 19th century, when they've abandoned various islands like St Kilda, is terribly moving to see the actual thing.
Oranmore Castle in Galway, that's become very important to you, hasn't it?
Yes, I started going to Oranmore in the 80s, and it became a home from home. It's a 13th, 14th century tower with its own key, right on the inner reaches of Galway Bay. And I've spent, I don't know how many weekends, Christmases, New Year's, just go there to work and get away from London. Leone, who was a student of mine in the early 70s, owned the castle, and her husband, Alec Finn, had a wonderful band called the Danann, which toured the world, but also attracted some wonderful musicians and singers to the castle. And we'd have wonderful evenings singing and joining in, and right through the night with the great fire burning in the great hall. Thank you. That takes me back to Oranmore about 2 o'clock in the morning with a huge fire blazing in the great hall and a glass of clear liquid in my right hand. I think they call it poutine. Just listening to these fantastic musicians, just enjoying themselves. It takes me right back to that piece.
We heard the Coulin performed by the late Alec Finn and De Dunan. Norman, printmaking seems to me like almost a form of alchemy. And you do use acid, don't you?
Oh, I use the full spectrum of acids, yes.
Just explain how that works, getting marks indented, as it were, into the plate.
Well, you work with various resists, mainly beeswax and various kinds of resin, and you melt them onto the plate, which can give a granular surface, or you can stop out perfect whites. And then you work with different acids. Some have different qualities. Nitric acid bites in all directions. Hydrochloric can be very violent. But you get to work with these things as naturally as you would work with oil paint or anything. And I work with them almost like watercolour. It's quite instinctive. You can measure things, but I'm past measuring now.
And the resin that you use for aquatints, is that the same thing as is used on a violin bow?
Yes, it's colophony. That's the finest aquatint resin. I always grind a little bit fresh each time. I could, of course, collect it from under a violinist's bow, couldn't I? But it's a bit like really good coffee. It's good ground fresh every time.
And you must, on your trips, have encountered some quite wonderful wildlife. I'm looking now, in fact, at a wonderful picture with birds in different aspects of flight, on their backs, turning, twisting, soaring.
Yeah.
Do you find artistic inspiration in the movement?
Well, it's almost like music, you know. A murmuration or a scattering of birds, they all seem to have a logic and a relationship to each other like notes do on the stave.
You know? If you drew 5 lines across the skyline on this picture, they would actually intersect almost like notes.
Absolutely. You've got one line that you've got to have, which is, as Gray said, now fades the glimmering landscape on the sight. And he's talking about the horizon as the sun's going down over it. So you've got that line. But you've also got the 4 lines of the rectangle. And the birds inhabit it. But I don't like to explore it too much, what I'm doing, you know. I like to leave it sort of unpredictable. I do something and I think, that's all right, and that's all I need to know about it sometimes.
Your love of music has extended to your children because your daughter, Poppy Ackroyd, is a composer.
Yes, she is. And she composed several pieces from trips that she's done with me.
Would it be lovely to hear the results of one of these trips?
Well, she was fascinated by the bird life. On a Ghana tree, the bird life is just absolutely intense. They nest side by side. And murmuration. She really gets the activity of the birds. I mean, you're in a frantic crowd, and these 6-foot wingspan birds just going about their business and ignoring you completely and making a hell of a row and a hell of a stink.
Thank you.
How lovely to be able to conjure up your trips with your daughter, Poppy Ackroyd, by hearing her murmuration from the 2021 album, Pause.
She's not a brilliant sailor either, because the first day is usually a disaster. But she's very brave to do it. The sea is not everybody's cup of tea.
We've been talking, Norman Ackroyd, about the process of etching. And we've got to the final process, which is inking up the plate and then running it through the printing press. One of the joys, because I'm sure you never quite know, like the sea, how it's exactly going to turn out.
No, you don't. I mean, you get a fair idea as you're cleaning the plate off of all the resins and things before you print it, because you go back to the bare copper and you think, this is looking good, and then you get very, very excited. But, of course, until the print's taken, you don't really know. And, of course, a print, when it comes off on its damp paper with the ink still glistening, has got a freshness, which is probably the difference between a live performance and a recorded performance. So the glistening print from the first pull is always exciting.
Do you ever get that sensation which we get in music sometimes, where the wrong note is actually the right note? In other words, something happens which is not quite what you planned.
But it's better than what you planned.
Yes.
And does that come out of a mistake, or does it come out of an instinct that you should make an intentional mistake, and maybe your years of experience of working has actually taken over from your intellectual thing, and it's just done it for you?
Well, that's the thing. Sometimes a player will say to you, did you mean B-flat or B-natural here? Because it could be either, and then that can be very exciting.
I always leave an element of the gamble.
Chance.
Chance. An element of chance. Because if you don't have the chance, you'd lose the magic. I'm trying to catch a butterfly, really, of a particular feeling. And you can't do that mechanically and intellectually.
We're going to end on a masterpiece. And this piece takes one to the very heart of the soul of being human, doesn't it? It's the Schubert Great Quintet, which has a kind of timeless element to it, as though it's actually depicting the fragility of the human condition.
It's something like that. It's monumental as well, isn't it? It's monumental. And you can put that on and you think, this is as good as anything. And what would this guy have done if he'd have lived to be 55 or 60, you know? It's got everything, and it's just incredibly moving. It's like a really good meal. It's fantastic.
Well, I can't tell you, Norman, what a pleasure it's been, indeed a meal, to go round your studios on all the different floors of this amazing building in Bermondsey, seeing the work in various stages. So it only remains for me to say, as we listen to the Adagio from Schubert's String Quintet in C Major, Norman Ackroyd, thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
The first part of the Adagio from Schubert's String Quintet in C major, performed by the Alban Berg Quartet with the cellist Heinrich Schiff. Today's episode of Private Passions was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael's guest will be the photographer, Sarah Lee. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds, and on most smart speakers, just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. The Prime Minister is resisting calls for an investigation into whether the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, broke the ministerial code after she was caught speeding last summer. Ms Braverman, who was Attorney General, the government's chief legal officer at the time, asked civil servants if they could help her book a one-to-one speed awareness course rather than a group session. They said they couldn't. In the end, she paid a fine and accepted the points on her driving licence. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said victory over Russia would mean lasting peace across the world. He's also flatly denied that Moscow's forces are in control of the eastern city of Bakhmut, despite saying earlier that Ukrainians only held it in their hearts. He was speaking on the final day of the G7 summit in Hiroshima. President Biden has said he's received assurances from Ukraine that it won't use American-made F-16 jets to attack Russian territory. The US has given permission for other countries to supply the fighter planes to Kyiv.
German police are investigating claims that two critics of Vladimir Putin were poisoned when they attended a conference in Berlin last month. Natalia Arno, who's head of the Free Russia Foundation, and an unnamed dissident journalist both complained of strange symptoms after attending the event. Russia has denied involvement. Police Scotland is investigating an allegation of sexual assault made against the former SNP council leader, Jordan Lyndon. Mr Lyndon, whose resignation led to the collapse of the party's administration in North Lanarkshire, also left the party earlier this year. The Sunday Mail says five men have made claims against him, with two speaking to detectives. Mr Lyndon said he did not accept the allegations. In tennis, Andy Murray's decided not to compete at this year's French Open. He's the latest big name to pull out of the tournament in Paris after Rafael Nadal and Nick Kyrgios withdrew through injury. Murray, who's 36, wants to prioritise the grass court season in the build-up to Wimbledon. The weather quite cloudy in northwestern areas with some light rain, brighter in the far north of the UK, dry elsewhere with sunshine for most, but low cloud in the southeast of England. BBC News, it's 2 minutes. Past one.
A very warm welcome to St David's Hall.
The Ulster Hall in Belfast.
Radio 3 in concert, taking you places night after night.
City Halls in Glasgow.
Stage Gateshead.
Please welcome tonight's conductor, Simone Menezes.
Here is principal conductor Ryan Bancroft.
For live music making of the highest calibre.
Yes, cheers from the audience here.
Well, what a completely thrilling and exuberant performance.
Mirga Grajanita-Tilar conducting the City of Birmingham.